is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, April 3rd, 2020. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York, and Taylor Schwenk is producing from his home studio in Connecticut. Today we'll be hearing from Hall of Famer Craig Biggio about what it was like to catch Nolan Ryan as a rookie. He's got stories about Roger Clemens, about his record for hit-by-pitches. We start, though, today with sad news about former pitcher and longtime broadcaster Ed Farmer of the Chicago White Sox. He passed away earlier this week at age 71. Terrible news. We'll talk more about Ed later in the show. A couple other news and notes. Tom Brady will be renting Derek Jeter's waterfront as he joins the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. If you've been in Tampa and you know where Derek's place is, it's like the size of a Best Buy. It's got like 20,000 square feet. Apparently enough room for Tom Brady. Justin Turner has an idea to end extra innings with a home run derby. He said this in an interview with Sportsnet LA. Give a listen.
You know, it's all on the table right now, and this is my opportunity to push for a home run derby in extra inning. Instead of playing 17 innings, yes. Just in that you get one extra inning, you play the 10th inning, no one scores, then you go to a home run derby. You take each team's three best hitters, and you give them all, you know, five outs and see who hits the most homers. And, you know, you want to keep fans in the stands till the end of the game. I know when I go to hockey games, I actually enjoy watching the shootouts. So that keeps me in my seat. So maybe a home run derby will do that as well.
Oh, fans would absolutely love that. I'm sure they would like to see that more than they would like to see Kike Hernandez pitching in the 14th or 15th inning somewhere in Philadelphia.
The traditionalists might not like it.
That's true.
Now, before we get to Todd and hear what he thinks about that idea from Justin Turner, I have a podcast you should consider for your weekend rotation, SV Pod. On the latest episode, SVP and Stanford Steve discuss how things have been going during the quarantine, which includes lots of Paw Patrol and trying to play NCAA 14. Plus, professional golfer Justin Thomas crashed the recording and did it without a shirt on to talk about how things have been going without tournaments. Find it wherever you get your podcast. Todd Radim, he's the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. Or you can go to his website, toddradim.com. Todd, how are you doing this week?
You know, sheltering in place like everybody else here, Buster. Another day, another week. We are doing the best we can, all of us.
Yeah, you live only about a dozen, 12, 15 miles from where I live, and it feels like you're about a billion miles away the way that life is going right now.
Tell me, I think we should meet halfway from a safe distance, wave to each other, and then just drive away.
Yeah, I did that with my next door neighbor. You know, for the last 21 years, I have a great neighbor, Joe DiMarzo, and I saw him yesterday, and we our dogs were running around between us, and we were keeping a safe distance, and which is what you got to do these days. All right, you heard Justin Turner's idea about a way to end extra innings. And I'd say this, Todd, before I get your view on it, this is inevitable that there's going to be some alteration with extra innings. You felt that in baseball for a long time. Front offices hate the wear and tear on pitchers. They hate the risk to position players. Players will tell you privately they can't stand those 18-inning games. And while I understand baseball purists are not going to like it, we got a window into what's coming during the WBC when they would put a runner at second base. Justin Turner's idea is just as good as any other, I guess. What do you think?
Well, Buster, speaking of Justin Turner and 18-inning games and the Dodgers, I did sit through that entire 18-inning World Series game, whatever it was in 2018 at Dodger Stadium, Red Sox-Dodgers. I don't know. I would like to hear Garrett Cole or Justin Verlander or Max Scherzer chime in on this and hear what they have to say from a pitching perspective. I do agree with you. We are the age we are, you and I, exact contemporaries again. So maybe we might lean toward the traditional, but something's got to give. I don't think this is it, though.
Okay. Well, I would say this. I should have qualified it in this regard. I don't think that the extra inning rules would necessarily apply in the postseason. Okay. But during the regular season, absolutely. Would that make you feel a little better about it?
I think we should have a blue chip committee and balance it out with media people, creative people like myself, pitchers, catchers, home run hitters, and come up with some equitable solution that moves things around that is not home run centric. How about that? Because I've also sat through every home run derby during All-Star Week for the last 25 years. And, you know, we all love the long ball and all that kind of stuff, but I think a more cerebral approach might be needed.
That's what the chief executive of our weekly quiz does. He proposes a blue ribbon panel and that he's on that panel. All right, let's get to this week's park. Marlins Park, what do you got?
Yeah, well, Marlins Park, guys, you know, it's an interesting one. Talk about traditionalists versus, you know, progressive. I have to say, I do like it. Let's first of all put into a little box the tortured process by which it came about, how it was funded, maybe even put into a different box the neighborhood that it's in, which is not the most accessible. But I really do like it. I like the colors. I like the textures. I like the feel of it. I love the fact that this is a ballpark with a defined sense of place and time. It could only be in Miami. It's built for the 21st century. I think it's a visual feast for the eyes. It's easy to get around. I have never been in there with the roof open. I've been in there a number of times with the roof closed. But I have to say, if you're thinking a little bit outside the box, why should a ballpark in Miami look like something retro or someplace that, you know, that's any place but Miami, which has a really great defined sense of place? What do we think?
Yeah, it's funny that you say all that, because it does feel like we need to put about four sets of blinders on, right? Forget about the funding. Forget about the accessibility. Maybe I thought at some point you might put in that special box, that old home run structure that Derek Jeter had ordered. Had that taken out of there. But I agree with you. I love the fish tank behind home plate. I was so excited to see that. Yes. And I agree with you. And as a colorblind person, I don't see all the everything that everybody else does, but I really like that park in a weird way.
Yeah, and in terms of the color's been suppressed a little bit in the last couple of years since Derek Jeter and crew took over. But again, that there's this blue tinted glass in the outfield, and you walk through the hallways, and you get this terrazzo tile, and it really feels like a cool beach experience. I don't know beach, but it's got a little Miami Caliente flavor. And let's face it, compared to what it replaced, Joe Robbie Stadium, Pro Player, all the various names that were attached to that ballpark, it is a marked improvement. If only people came, if only they had a decent team. I think they've got some comers in the minor league system. Buster, what are your memories of the old ballpark?
Terrible. I mean, yeah, it was not good. There was nothing redeeming about it in terms of baseball. I'm sure that if you're a Marlins fan, you know, Levon Hernandez with that great game he pitched, you know, to wrap up the World Series, the way that they filled that ballpark at that time. But generally speaking, no, there was absolutely nothing redeeming baseball wise about it.
No, I was going to say we have already started this discussion over the last couple of weeks, and this is going to be a continuing theme here. Ballparks and the memories attached to them, and I'll say it again, a stadium can get some good stink on it with some great moments. A bad stadium can get a better stink on it with some great moments. Whatever the merits or lack thereof of that stadium, which is now completely redone, Hard Rock Stadium, home of the Dolphins, it had two World Series championships attached to it, and those were pretty electric moments right there.
Yeah, 100%. And I know this didn't happen. Speaking of the Marlins second championship, this didn't happen in Pro Player Stadium. But I'll never forget being up in the press box writing the end of the 2003 World Series and looking down the field and seeing former Marlins owner Jeffrey Loria, who at that time was probably around 55, 60 years old, running around the bases like he was 10 years old at Yankee Stadium. that was an interesting memory. All right, let's get to this week's quiz. Taylor, you can chime in here.
All right, here we go. This is the oldest MLB stadium to have never hosted a World Series game. Is it A, T-Mobile Park in Seattle? B, Guaranteed Rate Field in Chicago? PNC Park in Pittsburgh? Or Oriole Park at Camden Yards? T-Mobile Park in Seattle, White Sox Stadium, Guaranteed Rate Field, PNC Park in Pittsburgh, or Oriole Park? Oldest current MLB stadium to have never hosted a World Series game.
Wow. Taylor, I'll let you go first. You won last week.
I guess I'll go with Oriole Park at Camden Yards. It's been open for nearly 30 years now. So that's a long time. And that seems a little bit longer than all those other stadiums that you just listed, but I could be completely wrong.
Todd, you put a softball in front of him. Come on, you know he's from that area. Camden Yards.
Oh, you're both right. And yes, it was a softball for him, but it was also a softball for you to some extent, Buster.
Yes.
I've got to level out old age and guile with specificity over here. So everybody's a winner this week. We're all happy. We all hunker down, and we live to fight another day, hopefully.
Love you,
yeah,
Todd.
Exactly.
Love
I appreciate
you.
It, Todd. Good to talk with you. Stay safe.
You too. Thanks, guys.
Craig Biggio played 20 years in the big leagues, 3,060 hits, 1,160 walks. He scored 1,844 runs. He was hit by 285 pitches, a record. He was inducted into Baseball's Hall of Fame in 2015. Craig, thanks for helping to distract us these days.
Buster, you're welcome, buddy. I mean, obviously, I wish it was under different circumstances and I had an opportunity to see you face to face, but, you know, the situation is what it is. And hopefully, you know, I saw on you earlier, everybody here in Texas seems to try to be doing their part. And, you know, hopefully we can get some positive news coming out of this thing sometime soon.
All right. So I didn't ask you this when I've seen you in person. I haven't asked you this question, but on that weekend that you were inducted into the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, I've heard so many great stories through the years about the conversations that take place on the back porch of the Otisaga or in the dining hall. Tell me about who you got a chance to talk to that weekend and what that was like for you that weekend you were inducted.
Wow. I mean, it's a pinch yourself moment. I mean, it's an opportunity to be part of a team that is the greatest team of all time. And everybody that I came across, everybody's been great. It was overwhelming, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, like you still got to make your speech, you know, and that's probably the most pressure that you have. And you have your family, you got all your guests and then, again, you know, getting back to, you know, having to make the speech is probably the most nerve-wracking thing and not missing anybody in it. But I just think it was just so cool. I mean, I'm a little bit older, so a lot of the guys there I played against. And obviously I've had a little bit of relationship with four in the past, but everybody just welcome to the team. Congratulations. And It's a special group of guys, and I'm honored to be part of it.
What was the conversation that you had that stuck with you afterward? Somebody that you enjoyed talking with, getting to know a little bit better.
Well, I mean, I used to, you know, get the opportunity, like with George Brett a little bit, hanging out with him, and getting the opportunity to, you know, Kansas City was right next to us in Kissimmee, so we played each other a lot of times. And There's only one good restaurant there to go eat at, Ruth Chris, and we all seem to go eat there all the time together. And you know, just, you know, going back and remembering this, you know, talking about with George and playing against George and for a little bit. And then just, you know, you're sitting, I get the opportunity at our Hall of Fame dinner that we have, which is still Hall of Fame players are in there. I mean, I sit at his table. So I get the opportunity to listen to some really good stories. Him and Robin Yount and a lot of the other guys, but nobody in particular, Buster. It's just like a brotherhood, man. It's just like everybody's just kind of hanging out and chilling and having a good time and enjoying the weekend.
What's it like then subsequently when other people are inducted now, like for example, Trevor Hoffman, who I'm sure you got to know during your playing career, when he's inducted? What's that been like for you to be the one to essentially to hand the green jacket to somebody in that position?
Well, it's the first year again. So you're going back to that first year. The first year is just like this. It's a whirlwind because your head's spinning. You got so many things that you're worried about. And then it's like every Hall of Famer said, hey, listen, Biz, don't worry about it. Just get through the first year. And then the next year is icing on the cake after that. And it's the same thing like with Trevor. It's like congratulations. And, you know, you enjoy the festivities and. But as a player, like you still got to make that speech. And that's the thing that makes you the most nerve-wracking. I mean, we were great at standing in a batter's box or you know, pitching on a sitting on a mound or doing our thing. But yet again, when you got to make that speech in front of everybody, you want to make sure that you don't forget anybody. But going back to the second year and every other year since then, it's just been fun. And it's just really, it's been fun, you know, to congratulate other guys and see them in that living in that left-hand lane doing about 120, trying to make sure that they get everything done. And then the year after that is just, like I was saying, icing on the cake.
How often do you want to go back and be a part of that? Do you plan on being a part of that?
Oh, every year. I mean, obviously my wife and I, every time we get it on the calendar and, you know, we look forward to it. We look forward. You know, what's fun about it is you going up there, it's just, you're having fun, just enjoying it. And, you know, every year you come away with a different relationship from a person that, you knew a little bit, but you get to know them more and more. And I think that's what's, it's really great.
The two primary guys on the regular ballot guys who are going to be inducted this year, Derek Jeter and Larry Walker. Give me a favorite Derek Jeter story from your playing days.
Well, I guess my only favorite story was that, you know, we were almost teammates, and I have no idea why we weren't teammates. And you're saying, well, what do you mean? He was a Yankee forever. No, we picked before the Yankees that one year, We didn't pick him. And could you think about that? How great that would have been. I had Baggy on my left, Jeter on my right, Caminiti at third. I mean, my gosh, that would have been so much fun. So I guess my favorite story is one that never really happened, because we had the opportunity. Would have been great to have played with him for 20 years. And then Larry Walker was obviously, I mean, I think that I'm so happy for him, because what an amazing player. People don't realize how great that guy. He was a legit five-tool guy. And, you know, and we went away on the Japan tour together. So, yeah, that's just one of those trips that you get an opportunity to go away with guys. And when you play against the guy, you get to know him a little bit. But when you spend some time with him, especially on a Japan tour like that, it was just so much fun to get to know him. And he's hysterical. But as far as, like, for the fans and the people, you know, Derek, everybody knows Derek and all the accolades and stuff that he did. But Larry Walker, man, I mean, he was a five-tool guy, run, throw, hit, defense, power. I mean, he was pretty special, and, you know, I'm really happy for those two guys. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen here, you know, with the Hall of Fame induction. Hopefully it happens, you know, but we're kind of just like we're all right now, we're living week to week and hoping for the best.
Now, I'm sure, because you're a baseball fan, so I'm sure you've heard mm-hmm. the story about the area scout who was working for the Astros that year, Hal mm-hmm. Newhouser, Hall of Famer, mm-hmm. Strongly recommends, begging the Astros, please take him, please take Derek Jeter. At one point, he wrote in his scouting report, he's a centerpiece of championship teams for years to come. And then when the Astros didn't pick Derek, then Hal just quit, walked away from baseball. He said, if I can't convince the Astros of taking this kid, then I can't convince anybody of anything. Did you ever, at some point, talk to Derek about that? Like, hey, man, how come we're not teammates?
Well, not really, because I really never got, you know, the interleague. You know, I got a little bit of age on Derek, by a couple of years, whatever. So the interleague, that's really the only time I really saw him. Is really, we played the Yankees, I think, one time in Houston, one time at Yankee Stadium is the only time I ever played there, and then in an All-Star game every now and then. So I really never got a chance to know him. I mean, never got a chance to really just sit down with him and talk to him. But I am looking forward to the induction weekend and going, can you imagine how fun that would have been? I mean, the right thing happened. I mean, he was great for the game of baseball, great for the Yankees, and what a tremendous role model for the game itself. But, I mean, how cool would that have been? I mean, I heard the story about the scout, and I'm like, listen, I love Phil Nevin to death. I mean, Phil is the guy that we ended up taking in number one, and I love Phil, and he's doing a great job in New York right now as a third base coach to Aaron Boone and everything. But, you have a Hall of Fame player that that you had the opportunity to play with. That would have been like crazy.
And Bish, he would have you watched Derek play all these years. He ran hard every time to first base. He would have absolutely fit in with sort of the dirt ball mentality that you guys had.
Yeah, he would have fit in perfect with us, because just, you know, your leader's got to lead, player's got to play, and you know, when your leaders play the game the right way, everybody else has got to follow suit. And he would have been a perfect fit for us or any team with that matter. But you can only kind of think, right? What would have been? I mean, I don't know how many shortstops I had in my career. It was a lot of them. It seemed like every year, every couple of years, there was a new guy. And I always had Daggy in my left hand side. But I mean, how cool would that have been to have like three guys on the infield play, you know, 15 years together?
Now, I know, having been around your group of players with you and Brad Ausmus and Jeff Bagwell, et cetera, that the humor was always irreverent. And Phil Nevin is someone with a great sense of humor. You know him better than I do. Did you ever tease him about that?
Oh God, we used to, we used to tease Phil about everything because he's young. He was a lot younger than we were, so he couldn't say anything back. And now as you get older, he's got more white hair than I do. And, but you know, we always used to have fun with him. I think when he came in for signing day, he had, he wanted number one, and we had Casey Candel. Casey Candel, as you know, is one of the most hysterical guys that that I've ever played with. And, you know, so we had a lot of fun with Phil and basically said, all right, you know, you're taking Casey's number. Casey's going to be like a half of a number one now or whatever. And put it on his jersey. Yeah, it's just little things like that. And Phil's like, oh my God, what I stepped into over here. But he's a good guy. Very good guy. Good person.
All right. So last May, this is what happened. You're in the stands and your son, Kevin, is in uniform for the Blue Jays. Give a listen to this.
Biggio sends a high fly ball deep down the right field line. It's gone! The first big league home run for Kevin Biggio.
The future has arrived.
That's a happy Hall of Fame dad right there.
Absolutely. What a terrific day for Crave and Calvin Biggio to share as a father and a son. His first big league hit, now his first big league home run.
That, of course, the voices of Dan Shulman, my old colleague from ESPN, Buck Martinez alongside in the Blue Jays broadcast. Tell me what was going through your emotions that day. In the previous at bat, he'd gotten his first major league hit, and then he hits his first major league home run.
Well, I appreciate, Buster, I appreciate the goosebumps again. I mean, that was pretty cool just listening to that again. And the foghorn that they got up there, or whatever that thing is, that is like awesome. Like when you hit a homer over there, that is like one of the coolest sounds ever. But you know, as far as you know, being there, you know, your son finally got his first hit in his third game, you know, and then he hits a ball down the line that's a literally bomb. You know, and then you're just like, you know, stay fair ball, stay fair ball, stay fair ball, stay fair. Because it was one of those balls that could have hooked a little bit too. You know, and then it goes 420 foot down the line in the upper deck. And it was just, I'm excited for my son. I mean, I got to say, we don't sit here and toot each other's horns here in our house. But he's a hard worker. He's a good kid. He works so hard. And I am so happy for him. And for my wife and I and my family to be there. Just to have an opportunity to witness that and see that, it was just a special moment. You know, like there's things that happen in the game, Buster. You know, you've been in the game forever too. It's like you see a lot of different things and you pinch yourself that, you know, hey, I had a great, what an unbelievable thing to be part of, to see live, you know, and then like, you know, for your son to get his first hit that day and then get then hit a homer. It was just, very surreal for us in our house. And we're real happy for him. And the Toronto Blue Jay organization, let me tell you, man, they are in one tough division, but they got a great thing going on right now. They've got it reminds me so much of us, the Houston Astros. Not me, Craig Biggio, the Houston Astros, but you know, like the George Springer, Jose Altuve, the Bregmans, and the players that we have today, and they're right there, man. They're going to be exciting and fun to watch.
So the video they showed, the camera was on you as he's rounding the bases and you appear happy and composed. I'm wondering what you felt like inside. And also when you saw him after the game for the first time after that, what was that like?
Well, again, it's, you know, you always got your game face on and you know how hard the game is. And, you know, you just had the opportunity to watch your son get a big league hit in the big leagues. And how hard that is itself. And then, you know, he hits a home run and then his best swing was the one when he hits the ball the other way for an RBI later in the game. And that was probably the swing that I liked the most. But after a game is really, it's just a hug, man. It's your son. I did what I did is okay. And we're over that. Right. But now your son is in the big leagues, getting the opportunity to play, you know, you coached him in high school baseball, you did all the summer stuff and traveled around and you do all your stuff, and it's the same stuff that every other baseball player does. But then after the game, it's really, you know, it's just a hug. It's a moment that, you know, I mean, I'll never forget, because, I mean, he's just so darn proud of the kid and how hard he's worked and having the opportunity to, you know, do Chase's dreams down. And he always wanted to be a big leaguer. I mean, it's just been, and now he's getting the opportunity to do it. And after getting a hit and the home run, it's just an embraceful hug as a father son. And, you know, you just, not a lot of words have to be said other than just squeeze each other nice and hard.
Now, you got to see so many things, great things in your career. You played along so many great players. So I want to ask you about different guys, and just if you had a friend who say, hey, tell me about this guy, what a story that sort of embodies that player. Let's start with your fellow Hall of Famer, Jeff Bagwell.
Okay, Jeff Bagwell, I mean, if you just want a funny story, I mean, tremendous player, Hall of Fame guy, obviously. He wouldn't catch any fly balls outside. So you said, what do you mean outside? So, like, if we were outside, not on a roof, I would have to go catch it. If I can get close to it, I'd have to go catch it. If we were inside, he had no problem catching it. He had bad eyes. Then he had Lasix. And then that helped him. But if we were outside and I could get to the ball, I had to catch it. So probably a lot of people don't know that one about him.
Yeah, I was going to say that's what exactly happened with Derek Jeter and Alex Rodriguez. Alex hated catching pop-ups, and Derek would always be calling him off because he knew that.
Yeah, right? So it's the same thing with Baggy. I mean, we went up in the air. If we were in the Astrodome or Minute Maid with the roof closed, he was good. But then it was open. Or if we're on the road somewhere and no roof was up there, then number 7 would have to try to run over there and catch it for him.
Ken Caminiti.
Oh, God, Cammy. He's one of my best friends. God bless him. I mean, I love that guy. Gentle giant. I think, you know, he had the facial hair, and he looked tough, and he looked strong, and he looked like a Harley Davidson rider, which he was. But I mean, Cammy was a gentle giant, man. I say it all the time. I mean, if Cammy had $5 in his pocket and it was the last $5 he ever had, and you asked to borrow it, he would give it to you. And that's just, God bless him. He's just a great man and a great friend, and I miss him.
Roger Clemens.
Roger, damn, guy could pitch. I tell you, I think I had one of the greatest seats in the world when I was in the couple of years that we played together, when I was in the outfield, center field, and you sit and you watch a guy who's a master in his craft and go out there and just pitch. You know, we've had a lot of great pitchers come here through Houston, and everybody different, unique in their own way. But watching Roger go out there and pitch, and especially in the National League, where he would manipulate his way through a lineup and not particularly, you know, you try to get the 1-2 guys out, but then, you know, you got 3-4-5-6, and then the National League 7-8-9 is a little bit different than the American League. And watch him manipulate his way through a game was pretty impressive.
I always thought that was very underrated about Roger, because of his big personality and the other stuff that happened later, was that fact that he was such a baseball fan. Like, he was a absolute baseball nerd to me, a baseball junkie.
Yeah. You ever give a friend his house? He's got all the baseball, and he's got stuff from everybody.
I didn't know that. I haven't been at his house.
Yeah. Yeah. All that stuff. Yeah. Big time.
All right. Andy Pettit.
Man, Andy Pettit, Andy is a gamer, man. I mean, he's just a gamer. He took the ball every time it was time for him to take the ball. You know, he was kind of like it was his day to pitch. It was his day to pitch. He put the hat down. You couldn't see his, you know, put the glove up. You know, all you could see is his eyes taking the sign from the catcher. And you know, he would always take the ball, and it was always his day. And being a guy that plays every day, I just appreciate the fact that, you know, when a starting pitcher, you know, he goes out there, whatever, 25, 32 times a year, that every time that they go out there and take the ball, it's their day. And I appreciate that. And that's what kind of Andy was. Andy was one of those dudes that was just like, hey, man, it's my day. I got you, boys. Let's go. Let's go play this game. And I'm all in. He's prepared. And one of the greatest pickoff moves I've ever seen. I've never seen it being on base, but I've seen it from the defensive side of things.
what do you got on Roy Oswalt?
Man, Roy. Roy was good, man. I'll give you just a funny story about Roy. I got heat exhaustion in St. Louis one time. I mean, it was 130 on the turf, smoking hot. I don't even know what the heck happened. All of a sudden, like the third inning, I'm out of the game. I got a bunch of jackets on. I'm shaking and doing all this stuff. So Roy would always make fun of me, right, about like getting heat exhaustion for whatever happened that day. So whenever I would play in a day game after that that was super hot, I always take one of those small little water bottles and I put it in my back pocket. And he'd always make fun of me for that. So I'm like, okay, whatever. I don't care. I just like if some pitcher's having a bad inning, I got to cool myself off. I need some water, right? So one day he was giving up batting practice during a day game in Chicago to the Cubs. And he whistles over to me. He goes, hey, pitch, pitch. I'm like, what? He goes, come here. He goes, you got that water bottle in your pocket? I'm dying. Pretty funny. So, you know, it was one of those little things.
Yeah, he comes from a family of loggers. And my favorite story about him, of course, I've got 1,000 stories about him, but he pitches that great game 6 in St. Louis. His dad, Billy, drives from their home in Mississippi, watches the game, gets in his truck, and then he's back in the woods at 6 a.m. logging the next day's trees.
And hunting too. I mean, Roy would always, he loved hunting. I love hunting. So we always had some good conversations about hunting. You know, what Roy is also good for is that he always has some pretty darn good moonshine too.
Tell me about Nolan Ryan, just getting to know him through the years.
Well, as far as, I mean, what you see is what you get with Nolan. I mean, he's class of class, man. I mean, he's just, you know, you think about the things that he has done just in his life, you know, as a baseball player. He's been, his jersey's been retired with 4 different teams or whatever it is. The all-time strikeout leader, is the all-time walk leader. I mean, you know, but Nolan Ryan is legacy. He's just, he is who he is. He did some great things with the Rangers, did some great things as a player. You know, their family is just class, they're class people. And, you know, that comes from mom and dad. And, you know, Nolan Ryan is just smart baseball guy, brilliant baseball guy. And, you know, my time and my relationship with Nolan is treasured. I mean, it was like one of the first games I ever caught was Nolan Ryan. All I did is put down one finger and he'd shake and I'd try to get the next finger. And then I just kept putting fingers down until I got the pitch he wanted to throw. And he was great, man. You want to talk about a warrior boy. When it was his day to pitch, it was his day to pitch, and he was pretty amazing at it.
You must have been scared to death as a young catcher.
Well, I wasn't, because I never got caught up with the name of the game. I never got caught up with the names. I never, because if I did, I was 22 years old catching Nolan Ryan, Mike Scott, Bob Knepper, Jim Deshaies, all these guys. But Nolan Ryan, I tell you another Nolan, the reason why I got to the big leagues is because, like, I went from, like, high A ball, no, low A ball to instructional league to Triple A that year. And then Alan Ashby got hurt, but Nolan Ryan was like, listen, you know, put him in Triple A, man. He's good behind the dish. And what Nolan was concerned about is really making sure that somebody could block his curveball, because that was a devastating pitch for him. You know, he had the power fastball, you know, but the devastating pitch was that curveball. And then he was concerned about guys that can block it. And I guess I was pretty good at it at the time. And I went from, like I said, low A to Triple A. And I think one of the reasons was because I got an opportunity to catch with him and work with him in spring training. And I don't know, he must have liked it. So next thing I know, I was in Triple A, and then I was in the big leagues right after that. So like within a half a year. So, I mean, it's pretty darn. So I never got caught up, Buster, with all the names. I never did.
You were, you and the Astros were ahead of the time, because you know now, you look around big league catchers, they're all about the size that you had. You know, Buster Posey, Will Smith of the Dodgers, et cetera, because they like catchers who can move.
No, I'm sorry. And that's what Yogi Berra, he was part of. Yogi was one of my dear friends. And, you know, he was on the staff. We had an opportunity to work together for 3 years or 4 years, whatever it was. And you want to talk about a brilliant baseball game. Yogi Berra was a genius back there as far as, you know, knowing the game, remembering the game and talking about the game. And size wise, I mean, I was a giant compared to him.
Absolutely. He used to walk into the Yankees clubhouse and I had people like, who's that? I'm like, that's Yogi Berra. Yeah. His little, you know, at that point, he's like in his late 70s, early 80s. And what was great about him is he was always current with his knowledge.
Unbelievable. See, people ask me a question, like, who's like the smartest baseball people you ever around? And Yogi Berra's at the top of my list, because he'd be like, he's always known for his yogiisms, whatever, which he was good for. But as far as his baseball smarts, I mean, he would say things like, I'm like, oh my God, what is he talking about? And then I'm like, oh, two innings later, three innings later, boom, boom, boom. I'm like, oh my God, I got so much to learn about this game. And I mean, he remembered stories and pitches, and I mean, he was, you're not as successful as Yogi Berra is. I mean, he was successful because he was smart. He was a smart baseball man.
Last topic for you. You set the record for being hit by pitches. Here's what it sounded like. Give a listen.
And Biggio now has the record all to himself. A grimace and maybe a grin for a moment. 268 times he's been hit in his career. That is a new major league record. He shared it for 24 hours with Don Baylor. And some Astro fans know of the record. They stand and applaud.
And I kind of like the fact that you broke the record in Colorado where Don Baylor was for a lot of years. Tough guy. And I wanted to ask you about that mindset to be in that position. I remember a few years ago, Anthony Rizzo, when he was a young player, he was having tough times with fastballs inside. So he made up his mind, you know what? I'm going to stand up on the dish and I'm not going to move. And I'm going to make them either hit me or throw the ball over the plate. And, you know, we've seen he's gotten just pounded. And yet it just became part of his mindset. How did you get to that point where you're able to do that?
It probably came back from football. I mean, I love football, and football is like my number one sport growing up as a kid. And so I love the sport and I love the contact, you know, then obviously it transitioned into catching. So you're still getting beat up. But for me, the mindset really was, I had a problem with trying to hit a ball low and away. That was my weakness. Like, so if you can hit the outside corner low and away, you know, I'm going to be strike one. But I just learned that just get on top of the plate for one and try to take away that outside half of the plate and try to make it into a semi strength for me. So that's what I did by trying to get onto the plate. So then by trying to get on top of the plate, then you also understand the pitcher's got to pitch inside and you're going to get hit. So for me, it was like, listen, Buster, I never went up there trying to get hit by a ball. I mean, but I was like, I tried to get a hit. But then again, I also understood that guys got to pitch inside. If we're going to pitch inside, you're going to get hit. And then the other facet of the game was like, this is like, okay, I got a cheap way of getting on base here. Well, not some of them, most of them hurt. Some of them don't, but most of them do hurt. But yet at the end of the day, my job was to get on base and steal bases and score runs for my team and get in scoring position. That was my job and my role. And so it was kind of like, listen, if you're going to come inside and I get hit, that's great. But now I can turn it into a triple. So the two things that reason for me is it's really one to make a weakness into a semi-strength by getting on the dish and trying to take away the outside half. And then the other was really trying to get on base. And then it was a free way to get on and score runs. And that's what I was paid to do.
And you did it well. Craig, thanks for doing this, and thanks for taking the time and telling us some stories.
You're welcome, Buster. Yeah, everybody be safe out there. Thank you.
We talked with Tim Kirkjian on Thursday about his daily baseball fix. Here's his edition for today.
On this date in 1966, the Mets signed Tom Seaver out of USC. He went on to become one of the 10 to 15 greatest pitchers of all time. He became the greatest baseball player ever to wear uniform number 41, and he was by far the greatest Met ever. He was a star in New York, and therefore he befriended Dick Schaff, the great writer, the great TV personality, and one of the great interviewers of all time. Dick liked to say that he collected people. So one night he got a bunch of his sports writer friends with Tom Seaver, Muhammad Ali, a few other celebrities, and they all went out to dinner. And Ali, a brilliant man but not a great baseball fan, looked at Tom Seaver at the end of the night and whispered to him, "Which newspaper do you work for?"
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster, Bleacher Tweets for Friday. What do Fridays even mean anymore? It's arbitrary
You're right.
At this point.
We had to just do podcasts all through the weekend or not.
Hey, we've discussed plans to record things, so we're not that far off from it. First one for today, Ryan Sheldon at Ryan of Silverton writes in, "It's very simple. Andrew Jones belongs in the Hall of Fame. Why is he only getting 7.5% of the vote? He has more career WAR than most of the people above him. What's the deal with this, Buster? Any ideas?
Yeah, he hasn't gotten votes in part because he got caught up in the backlog of all those steroid era candidates who hung around the ballot. I mean, currently you got Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds for years, Mark McGuire, Sammy Sosa, and I think he suffered because of it. Based on some decisions in Hall of Fame voting the last couple of years, Andrew Jones should be in the Hall of Fame.
Here's another Hall of Fame question for you. Mark Sherman at Shark Merman writes in, should Curt Flood be in the Hall of Fame?
I don't think so. I do think, for example, one obviously incredibly historic figure in baseball history, maybe the most important, was Jackie Robinson. And people remember him most for breaking baseball's color barrier, but he was also a tremendous player. You know, rookie of the year winner, leader on that Brooklyn Dodger team for 12 years. And Curt Flood, I don't think his career production rises to the level of the other guys. Now, there are places in the Hall of Fame where if you want to learn about Curt Flood and his importance in baseball, that is certainly recognized.
Eric Detweiler writes in, will Hinch and Lonow be blackballed for a year if there are no games? Interesting hypothetical here.
No. I think A.J. Hinch is going to manage at some point. You know, I don't know if it's going to be right away in 2021. Jeff Lunow, I don't know. Because he wasn't someone who was really well-liked in other front offices. There's no doubt he was respected, but people would have to extend themselves to give him another opportunity. And given his response after the suspension came down, where he's quite defiant in the statement he put out, I don't know if people will be willing to buy into that.
Yeah, that seems like a big sell to a fan base. Last one for today, Corey Rueckert at CoreyR_12 writes in, if Randy Johnson were to pitch in today's strikeout-heavy game, how much higher would his career strikeouts per nine innings of 10.6 be?
Corey, an interesting question, and without having actually dug into the specific math, you know, I should ask Sarah Langs to do this for us next week. My guess would be up to about 12, you know, between 12 and 12.5 per nine innings. But there's no doubt every year the strikeout numbers jump as pitchers throw harder and hitters adapt to this with this all or nothing approach at the plate.
That'll do it for Bleacher Tweets for Friday. Please subscribe, rate, and review to this fine podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. If you haven't listened to any of our interviews, any of the stuff we did this week, obviously the weekend, great time to just roll through those as you're, humming around the house doing whatever. And next week, we have some exciting guests coming up. But you want to tease a couple of those, Buster?
Sure. We're going to be talking next week. ESPN is going to be running a rebroadcast of Cal Ripken's consecutive game number 2131. That's, of course, when he broke Lou Gehrig's record. And we're going to be talking with his longtime teammate, Ben McDonald, about some of his memories. And next week, we're going to have Managers Week. We're going to be talking with managers, and our leadoff hitter will be Joe Maddon. And we'll hear about what he was thinking in extra innings of Game 7 of the 2016 World Series. My thanks today to Craig Biggio, to Todd Radom, to Tim Kirchin, to Taylor Schwenk. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. I do want to give you one final thought on Ed Farmer, the longtime pitcher and announcer for the White Sox who passed away this week at the age of 71. I got to know Ed a little bit. You know, I'd bump into him. Man, was he passionate about baseball. He was so specific in his knowledge, and he was so funny. Like, he's one of the – I mentioned when we talked to Bill Ripken last week, he was one of the funniest people I met in baseball. Ed Farmer would be on that list. This great, acerbic sense of humor. I saw yesterday in social media how his broadcast partners from his time with the White Sox, Darren Jackson, very heartfelt thoughts about Ed. Chris Singleton, our colleague here at ESPN, who used to work for the White Sox, had some great thoughts on him. And I wanted you today, at the end of our show, to hear from Ed Farmer about his journey into baseball. This is from the White Sox.
Very pleasant. Good afternoon, Chicago. Alongside Darren Jackson and Farmer, glad you're with us, friends. Turn on the fireworks. Sox win! Sox win! Paul Brother, what a game!
I just love the game of baseball. My mom got me a glove. It was a glove she bought at the Five and Dime store at Kresge's. I learned how to play catch with Charlie Thompson across the alley in the neighborhood, 79th and Francisco. It was a way I could get through things because I didn't speak well. I was 5 years old and I didn't know how to pronounce words. And my dad said to my mother one day, he goes, Edwards is a little slower than the other kids, you know. So it was a way for me to break through that barrier and have people notice me. And my uncle loved the White Sox. My godparent took me to see him play, and I was hooked at Comiskey Park. My address has been 35th and the Dan Ryan since I was 11 years old, basically, because I used to ride the bus up 35th Street with Tommy and come to the ballpark here at Shields at 35th. That's how he got here. And Tommy and I would get here early. We'd take the tickets because we were juniors. We could cash the ticket in, and then we could have a couple of hot dogs during the game with a refund we got for a box seat. I wanted to be the best player in my neighborhood, and I think I became that. And I had a scholarship to St. Rita. Also played on the basketball team, but I've had a deformed left knee since I was born, and I really didn't want to play football, but baseball. I want to be the best baseball player, one of them in the city. That expanded to being one of the best baseball players in the state. My mother, Marilyn, no doubt about it. She honed me to a fine edge. I walked into Comiskey Park, and I told my mother, I said, someday I'm going to play here. She goes, Edward, if you're good enough, and I got to play here and was an all-star here for the White Sox.
From the Chicago White Sox, pitcher Ed Farmer.
One reason the White Sox have enjoyed good success thus far this season would be that man, the big right-hander Ed Farmer, coming on in the bottom of the sixth inning. As Rose, it's a bouncer down to Randolph. Willie over the out, one, and back to first, double play.
And when I went to the All-Star game, I had 17 saves. I went from pitching better the year before, saving 14 games, and I saved 30, setting the club record here for saves. And I was actually bleeding internally with the cyst popping in my kidneys, from polycystic kidneys. It's the number one genetically passed disease in the world. And my mother, she had that. She was gone at 37. And I inherited that gene, and so did three of my brothers and sisters.
Good friend Ed Farmer has worked tirelessly to promote the organ and tissue donor program. For almost 20 years, we have worked together to register people for this meaningful program. He's the voice of the White Sox, but he's also the voice of humanity.
So my brother Tom gave me a kidney transplant 28 years ago. Gave me his kidney. He walked in and it looked like a great shark had bit him in half. You know, he had this big scar around his belly button to the back, but it actually was an identical match. So saved my life. My brother Tom, yeah. I was assistant general manager at Baltimore, national cross-checker, along with going with Roland Heyman into different areas to work on trades and get things done. And Roland turned to me and goes, Larry Lucchino wants you to call him tomorrow. So I called the Oriole office the next day, and he goes, the White Sox want to talk to you. I don't want you to sign anything, but call them and find out what they want. So I called them, and I called Larry back, and I said, they want to make me the special assistant to the senior vice president of baseball operations. Silence. Nothing. And he goes, what is that? I said, I think that's the assistant GM. He goes, you're already that here. I said, they also want me to do radio on Sundays, and that could interest me. Yeah, that's how I got the job. I did Sundays, and I had to be wherever the team was on Sunday. So I'd be out scouting, and I'd get a flight on Saturday or Sunday morning into where we were playing that afternoon or that evening.
And Tim has four home runs. He's driven in 14. And the pitch swung on high, deep to left. Got a chance. There's a trap. It's down. Game-winning home run. Light it up. Sox win.
This is a great seat. Please, it's a boyhood's dreams growing up as a White Sox fan. It is. It's great to call the game.
Game-winning home run by Anderson is fifth. White Sox were down France 9-2 at one point.
This is something that doesn't happen to everybody, and I understand that. It's great to be a White Sox fan. Well, it's a family here. That's what it is. I've got a great partner with Darren Jackson. We get along great. My closest friend outside my family. For my partner and me, we want to win. You can hear it in my voice. I don't come to lose a baseball game.
And the 0-1. Alonso swings. Line drive left field. That's down for it. One run scores. Up with it. A hesitant throw. Sox win. Sox win.
I'm here to do one job. Do the broadcast. Call a White Sox winner. Hopefully get to the playoffs in the World Series again for all the fans, because I'm a huge White Sox fan as well.
for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.